Hi, this is Blogging Heads. I'm Harry Siegel with the New York Daily News, columnist and editorial board member. I'm here with Joel Kotkin, executive editor of New Geography, distinguished presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University, Orange County Register editorial board member, and writer of many books, and generally very interesting guy. So, Joel, you wrote for us for the Daily News about a week ago that the idea that that New York's what was once called Silicon Alley, but that the tech business here, the idea that we were catching up with or approaching the West Coast was just ludicrous. I'm curious about that because I went to the Google headquarters and I had lunch. I was at the Daily Beast at the time, and they wanted to sell us a suite of products, and they took us to their cafeteria. And this was a literal cornucopia. It was incredible. There was we're on the 8th floor of a building in Chelsea. There's an ice cream truck. There's beautiful outside views. There's literally $100,000 of free food. I'd never had this happen at Howard Johnson. It defeated my buffet capacity. Right. And there was just this sense that here's unlimited goodness and wealth. Would you like a bite? Let's do some business. So I mean, tell me why you think that especially with Cornell Tech coming here, that the idea we're going to compete is a myth.
Well, it's a myth as long as you have such a weak engineering community. I mean, right now with the social media, boomlet, which I think at some point will go through its course like the .com one did, is better for a place like New York than traditional engineering-based technology. But if you take a look at what's happening even today, all the most powerful internet companies are almost all of them are either in the Bay Area or Seattle. As we begin to move into things like robotics, home devices, the engineering horsepower just isn't in New York. New York has one of the lowest per capita engineer counts in the country. It just doesn't have the engineering power, and it doesn't have the engineering schools that the Bay Area has and even that Los Angeles has. So I think fundamentally, to think of New York as a engineering tech center is kind of, a bit of a farce. But of course, any two people with a computer can get their picture in the New York Times, and that creates an impression that something tremendous is going on. But even if you look at information employment in New York, I don't think it's in particularly good shape, because whatever you're gaining on the internet side, you're getting clobbered on the newspaper, magazine, and book side. And those are all industries where New York is completely dominant.
Well, we don't like to hear that here at the Daily News, Joel.
Bad. I spent my life in this stupid industry, so I can smell the stench of all the bodies, because I've seen virtually my entire generation of journalists really go through just tremendously bad times as we've gone through this transition.
So you don't think that adding Cornell Technion here is potentially a game changer, which is really how Mayor Bloomberg presented it, is that this was going to shift our economy into a new century, make us competitive in these industries, allow the companies that did start here and gained a foothold, like Foursquare, for instance, others who are adding space here, like Google and Twitter, to give them the talent they want. Obviously, Richard Florida has a whole thing about how the creatives want to cluster in these sexy, dense urban environments. You see it in the sorts of buildings they're putting up to house these companies here. You don't think this is the future, I take it.
Well, basically, the reality is most of the serious engineering and engineering management is going to be done by people in their 30s and 40s. And most of them don't make enough money to live decently in New York. I mean, that's, it's as simple as that. And if they're going to spend the money and they're in their 30s and 40s and they're married and they want to have kids, they're probably going to be better off being in Sunnyvale than being in Manhattan. I mean, it's just, it's just sort of, what the basic pattern has been. Engineers as a group, and I've spent a lot of time with them, for the most part, some of the younger software guys are different. But as they get older, they're fairly conservative in their lifestyle choices. They want a house. They want a backyard. They might want to have kids. They like cars. They like gadgets. Living in a 300-square-foot apartment in Manhattan is probably not what they're going to want as they get older.
But if this was the case, like why would Manhattan do well at all? I mean, it's not new that as people get older, suddenly they're more concerned about schools. They want a backyard for their kids. Like having a place where it's very easy to bring a date home, and right. and maybe score becomes less of a concern. And yet Manhattan has done very well, and New York has. So I mean, help me out here.
Then that works well in finance. It works somewhat in media. Of course, you have a huge, tourism sector. And of course, in the case of New York is a very unique place because it's a global city and so much of its economy is integrated with, money coming from other parts of the world. So, many of the new fancy buildings are inhabited or not inhabited by owners who are from other countries or from other parts of the United States. So, I mean, New York is definitely unique. I just think that at this stage of the game, Silicon Valley is so far ahead. It has such a bigger infrastructure. It has so much more in venture capital. It has so much more expertise. You know, what we're seeing is in the Silicon Valley is a kind of oligarchy that really, these niches are huge, but once you get them, very hard for anyone else to get into it. So there tend to be, that's why they're oligarchs, because they gain control, let's say 80% of search between Apple and Google. You have the vast majority of operating system software. And all that stuff is put together in Silicon Valley, to some extent.
Not physically.
What?
Not physically. Like when there's physical stuff, it's not put together anywhere by us.
Right. Well, it's put
together. I guess a lot of this doesn't have physical stuff anymore.
Right. But the stuff that does have physical stuff, that's almost all either in California or it moves out to Texas. It just doesn't go to New York. It just, the infrastructure, let's say if you're going to build stuff, you're probably not going to do it in New York. You're probably, in some cases, you're not going to do it in California either. But the engineering horsepower is so much greater in the Bay Area. And New York is, as I mentioned, take a look at STEM jobs. If you take a look at high-tech jobs, New York is just not on a per capita basis competitive with Silicon Valley. And it does. What we have to understand is the nature of the keiretsu that have developed. These groups of people who sit on the same boards, who know each other, whose kids go to school together, who are just in many ways like the financial oligarchs, which New York has plenty of.
Well, it's very convenient to have that group in close proximity, in part because it helps them fix prices with engineers. So obviously,
right.
There's been a big push for immigration reform among a lot of the tech elites that seems, just on the face of it to me, like, hey, we need cheaper labor. Past that, you've got these huge companies that are right by each other in Silicon Valley who just don't poach each other's engineers generally. Google, Apple, Facebook, and Twitter seem to do what MLB used to do after free agency started and just said, hey, I'm not going to steal your guy. You don't steal mine. We'll all save money. And when you consider just how few jobs these companies create compared to classic manufacturing firms, say, it's even more distressing when that money gets cut off. Yeah, yes. Yeah. How many employees does Citibank have? I'm going to check.
It's over 100,000, I would imagine.
It's definitely six figures in the U.S.
And of course, when I work in Singapore, and their huge presence there. Look, the bottom line is what we have. Let's say we'll take the techno coolies, as the Indians call it. The people who the H-1B visas. This is an absurdity when you think about it, that half of all American IT graduates can't get a job in IT, at least half. We're graduating these people. You may argue you could get better quality for less money by bringing some kid, from Mumbai into, live in an apartment in San Jose, which a middle-class American kid probably wouldn't find very attractive.
So what do you think about all this talk about the skills gap and that we've got the jobs, we're just not educating people who have the skills to fit these jobs? The president was recently with Bill de Blasio at this school, this public school in Brooklyn, where over 6 years you end up getting your high school and associate's degree and going into tech work. IBM has put money into it. I mean, there's a lot of talk about how, in fact, the issue is we don't have people who can do this work. Is that wrong?
Well, I think we have people who can do the work. I just think we don't want to pay them for that much. I think that's one big factor. Where we have some very severe shortages, frankly, is not in the upper echelon of the IT, where we really have some of our biggest problems are really in, plumbers, mechanics, the hard sciences, which we've largely abandoned. Like automobile companies, even now after a huge recession, have shortages of engineers and skilled labor. So we definitely have skilled labor shortages. I'm not sure they're necessarily people who that we don't have enough people to work at Facebook. I don't think that's really. And frankly, I'm not so sure that Facebook does so much for the economy either. But that's another story.
So how is San Francisco these days? Let's shift coasts and talk a bit about this. There's a lovely idea floating around that the Silicon Valley should basically secede and California should split into six parts.
Right.
This is Tim Draper, who's a venture capitalist out there. And the basically Silicon Valley should show how good it would be if tech was allowed to literally be its own state, not quite a nation state yet. And obviously it would have a much, much higher per capita income than the other five mini Californias.
Well, of course, this is very convenient. You get rid of all the people feel that you have to support. And you have to remember, even within the Silicon Valley itself, and certainly in the Bay Area, there are some tremendous pockets of poverty. I mean, Oakland is a basket case. San Jose has the largest homeless camp in the United States. Incomes for Hispanics and African Americans actually have been dropping in Silicon Valley. The percentage of women and minorities working in Silicon Valley outside of Asians has been actually dropping. So I'm not necessarily sure that it would be such a great success, but clearly the mentality in Silicon Valley is heavily, we're better than everyone else, and either you let us do things on our own or we'll tell you what to do. It's really interesting because I started covering Silicon Valley about 40 years ago. And at that time, it was a bunch of engineers and they were kind of modest. They were the typical, the geeks with the plastic pencil holders, in their jackets, and they would drink, machine coffee out of styrofoam cups and take sandwiches out of machines. And they were amazingly, in many ways, democratic in the small D sense. Now what you have are people who are, in quote, politically very progressive, but are unbelievably elitist. I mean, how do you go around saying, like the guys at Google, they'll say, well, we have to reduce the carbon footprint. Oh, and by the way, we have our fleet of private jets in San Jose. People who live at a level that is infinitely larger than anybody needs to live. And I don't care. If rich people want to spend their money ridiculously, that's their business. But I don't want to be told by those same rich people that I have to dial down my, rather modest middle-class quality of life in order to meet some sort of ideal of theirs.
So let me ask you a question here. Why are these plutocrats hated on so much less than say Wall Street bankers?
Well, of course, I always feel Wall Street bankers, are particularly, as a group, a reasonably despicable group. The only good thing is that some of them are at least open about their greed, which is better than some of the tech guys. But, let's face it, Wall Street increasingly makes money for other rich people. It doesn't make money for people in general. So, I think there's sort of a feeling is, well, this is a rich guy's game and I don't get anything out of it. well, at least, you know, Apple gives me an iPhone. I get to play games on you know, some video game platform.
Oh, don't be such a snob. These are really useful tools. We're having this conversation on their tools, right?
Right, and you know what? And I think it's great that they're compensated for it. I have no problem with people being worth, you know, $2 billion, $3 billion who started a company, worked really hard, and employed people. But what I do have a problem is when somebody makes $19 billion for selling an app in order to keep it out of the hands of somebody else. And by the way, as a consumer of this technology myself for a long time, I don't see that as these tech guys have gotten richer, that the technology has improved all that much. I think of the problems we've had just getting this call together. is Microsoft, is Windows 8 better than XP? I don't think too many people would say there. What was the improvement there? Is the Google search engine better now than it was 5 years ago? I mean, actually, as we get more of an oligarchic system, we have less competition. You know, I remember the Valley in the 80s when we had like 40 disk drive companies and 40 or 50 PC companies.
Oh, and they were building these things, right? Like disk drives and PCs, which is part of why it's in the Valley, right? And not in the city. So you have space for industry.
Exactly. And that, but also what you had was unbelievable levels of competition. New products coming out all the time, displacing old products. Now you've got, you know, monopolies that, you know, that the oil companies and the auto companies would love to have. I mean, you're talking about industries where, you know, you have relatively small numbers of players, in some cases only one player. And I think we're going to end up having the same crisis we had in America over 100 years ago with the trusts, where there'll be small groups of guys. Look, did Carnegie and Rockefeller and Harriman, did they accomplish something great? Yes, they did. But at some point, society has to look at itself and say, wait a minute, $19 billion for an app company that doesn't make money and has no way that anyone can see that can make money, that's $4 billion more than Putin was trying to buy Ukraine with. I mean, we're talking about disequilibriums that are mind-boggling.
That's WhatsApp, right? Yeah. How many employees do they have?
50.
And $19 billion.
Right. The founder of the company is now one of the richest men in the world.
No, Joel, they're 55. They're 55, so back off a little there.
All right, okay. But, I mean, the bottom line is that you know, what we're seeing is there is an economic and technological transition, which is you know, happening. And as occurred during the height of the Industrial Revolution, there was a great process of consolidation and, of course, a tremendous amount of political power gathered by very small groups of people. And, you know, society, you know, it's very possible that we needed this kind of development to get to where we are now. We have to start to think about, over time, whether or not we want to have a society in which, you know, 50 guys in Silicon Valley, you know, have more assets than the rest of the population. I mean, that, you know, if you want to go in that direction, you can. I don't think it's I think that as Justice Brandeis said, you can't, you know, you can have a choice. You can have great concentrations of wealth or you can have a democracy. You can't have both.
If Google will open up its cafeteria to all New Yorkers, this would change my mind. What's incredible is their salespeople were not very good. They weren't especially interesting. They weren't especially impressive. They didn't pick up things we were asking when in terms of what our particular use was. They had this suite of products, some of which more or less sold themselves. And they had this incredible cafeteria. It was like really just the cherry on top of this. It was just unlimited, wonderful, delicious things with very good chefs cooking them. As I said, like an ice cream truck on the 8th floor of the building that had been towed up there. I forget which one, but one of the very cool, sexy ice cream trucks. It was just like a magical environment. The thing is, they never invited me back. We didn't buy anything either, I don't think. I was honestly just tagging along.
Did you eat anything?
I ate everything, Joel. I had like 3 helpings of steak. I had like 6 desserts. I was a little stuffed. But so, it was incredible, and this
the
really
bar mitzvah every day.
Clearly part of the pitch is this is what they're offering. But at the same time, I mean, I don't know. It seems to me that some of these questions are almost irrelevant in terms of how we're going to organize our society as these machines get smarter and smarter in some really disturbing ways. I had to send a serious note about something this morning, and my first four thoughts for a subject line for this, I ended up sending without one. I had to not do, you know, like something like terrible news, because I was worried that they were going to get caught in spam filters, that I was going to fail the Turing test. I mean, we seem to be at a moment of some very obvious and significant social shifts. Obviously, a lot of these platforms, Google and Facebook in particular, are trying to, you know, harvest our information and use it to develop things that can anticipate our needs, increasingly think for themselves. We're looking more and more at wearable devices and a new sort of cybernetics that's hard to even wrap our heads around. Like the automobile was just training wheels for 100 years before we got to this. That on some level make me say, what does it matter if these companies are spiking now? It's at the end of something. So in Darkness at Noon, there's a beautiful extended thing about how history works, where it's in chambers. And basically you have some technological innovation and society's at the bottom of a chamber. Slowly it rises and it figures out the social forms and the political forms and the structural forms that align around that technology. On the way that slavery and indentured servitude ends around the world in about a 60-year stretch.
Right.
Actually, a little longer. Let's say an 80-year stretch. As suddenly, you don't just need massive amounts of human power for most industries. And the industries you still do, like, for instance, picking cotton, are the laggards that fight hardest against this. So at some point, it seems like we're just at the bottom of a brand new chamber. So sure, these companies are making a ton of money. But in some ways I'm more concerned about like the robot future and what it's going to mean for my my human progeny than any of this.
Well, I
but take us way left field.
I mean, the problem is that when you have such enormous amounts of power, and I'm particularly worried about the theft, if you will, of you of people's information, so that Eric Schmidt will say, well, we know what you're thinking, what you're doing. I don't want that. And so as this power becomes greater, it becomes more incumbent on society to restrict this power in any kind of reasonable way they can do it.
But you do want free email, right? And like for your search thing to have some idea what you're after and not take you in some wasted other direction.
Well, yeah, but you could certainly get compensated without having to know everything about me. I mean, and the deal that we've made, which is a Faustian deal, which is that we'll get to use these in quote free services, but meanwhile they have a right to take every ounce of our privacy away from us, is scary. And what's scarier, even more so, and I find this with my students, is a lot of them are only now beginning to understand what privacy means. You know, when you're a young person, you know, maybe you think it's fun that everybody knows that you went out and got wasted last night. When you're 32 years old and waiting to see if you're going to get a job or not, it's not so great. When you have children, you're much more protective of your privacy, or at least you should be, than when you're a single person, you know, out on the market. But we are really, we are playing, you know, in a way, we're playing with fire. We're playing with incredible technologies in the hands of very few people. And if you think that they're doing it for the greater cause of humanity, I think that you need some very serious history lessons.
That's only the national government and the NSA that's doing it that way, right?
You know, the NSA thing, you know, bothers me, but I'm more bothered, frankly, by the other, because the other is more pervasive. The attempt to know everything about you, what you're buying, what you're not buying. At what point does this begin to become something that you can package and sell to an employer or something that may end up determining, you know, what your credit rating is? I mean, there's a lot of things that we are essentially handing to a very small group of people who, once they have you think about this. And I, you know, and look, I use a Windows computer and I've spoken at Microsoft, but here's the reality. You know, they have been able to maintain an enormous amount of money with a product that very few people think is particularly good. And they've had, with the exception of, you know, the competition from Apple, almost no significant threat to their oligopoly. And we're going to see that happening more and more. Google is an oligopoly. Facebook may be an oligopoly. Microsoft and Apple are kind of, you know, sort of a two-headed one. Google is certainly an oligopoly. And this is really something that we should be concerned with. Just as we were right, we shouldn't have allowed Standard Oil to control the majority of the American oil business, because it was anti-competitive and bad for the economy. And not to mention that, bad for the society. I mean, this is something that Jefferson and Madison were very clear on in their writing.
Did they consider the robot future?
They didn't consider, but you know what? I think one problem, no offense to your generation, but the problems are not necessarily unique historically. They, you know, the formulations are the same. So let's just say, like, you start with Google, and maybe they were great guys and they were incredibly idealist and they were amazingly innovative and they had really good intentions.
No evil, right? Yeah.
But of course, as was later said, evil is whatever Sergey Brin says is evil. Well, you know, I mean, that's not exactly comforting. But the idea is that if you have this group of people with so much of with so much money, people change. I mean, haven't you ever had a friend who, you know, was like one way and then they became incredibly successful, incredibly wealthy, and their tastes, you know, about who they went out with, who they married, where they lived, what was important, had changed dramatically to be in the bubble, just like you and I may travel into the upper middle class bubble, and the idea of going back to merely middle class would be, you know, horrifying. Well, for these people, they are at such a high level that it you know, it corrupts. You know, it's the old saying, absolute, you know, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so people who may have been very idealistic at one stage, they become motivated by other things, and
there's a monologue about this in the in St. Elmo's Fire. But yeah, look, people who start hugely successful giant companies become rich, and their motives and interests change. This is troubling. It's not, you're right. It's anything but ahistorical, and it's not unique to tech. I know you're concerned with that. I am seriously deeply concerned about the robots and what the future holds for humanity as I recognize and understand it, and unaugmented man and all that. But let's go to San Francisco for a second.
Okay.
And talk about what's happening there, where there's you're getting into some really interesting fights as tech employees live there. A lot of them commuting out to the valley, about the buses that are taking them out, about what is a public service in a city, what people's fair expectations can be, and the sense that this has become like an enchanted tech cluster in some weird and troubling ways that are infuriating other people there. So you're on the West Coast, I'm in New York. Fill me in.
Well, okay. Now, you know, I of course I live in Southern California, but I did go to Berkeley, and I did report for many years in the Valley, and spent a good deal of time. My first job was in San Francisco. You know, San Francisco was a weird place, always has been. It's a very small place. It's, you know, by the standards of a New Yorker or even an Angeleno, it's a small, you know, it's a relatively small, compact city. So when you get, let's say, an increase of 30,000, 40,000 tech jobs in a city of 700,000, it changes the whole ecology of the city. And San Francisco has been battling with this for a long time. When I moved to the Bay Area in the early 70s, San Francisco still had a working class. It still had ethnic neighborhoods. It still had you know, it was still something of a normal city. You knew people who grew up there. There were neighborhoods like the Sunset, which were almost like parts of South Brooklyn or parts of Staten Island.
And let me just say, San Francisco and Seattle, if you combine them, you know, you've got 2/3 of the population of Queens. So these are smaller, more easily tipped infrastructures.
Right. And you know,
environments, yeah.
And of course, San Francisco in particular, and Seattle also, interestingly enough, have very politically radical tradition. You know, they used to, James Farley referred to Washington State as, you know, he said there were 49 states in the Soviet of Washington. So you have this very, very bifurcated class structure imposed on a region whose historical mythology is egalitarian. Now, Seattle is better off than San Francisco. A, it's not as expensive. It has much more affordable areas, particularly in the suburbs, and it has Boeing, and it's not as dependent on tech as and narrowly defined as the Bay Area is. But it, you know, the place has changed over the years. It doesn't have the feel that San Francisco used to have. The whole sense of it being a port city or the last parts of its manufacturing culture are almost gone now. Neighborhoods that were middle and even working class are now out of the reach of almost anyone. You go out to the Sunset District where the nurses and teachers used to live in little houses with tiny backyards. Those houses are $1 million, $1.2 million, $1.3 million. But the difference is, whereas in a city the size of LA or New York, there's always some other neighborhood to move to because the place is still very, very large and also obviously has a lot of working class areas. In San Francisco, you're just simply running out of it. Remember, San Francisco is about 800,000 people, but Manhattan has 2 million, just Manhattan itself. So the scale is different. These conflicts are very intense. And San Francisco has a very, very well-developed far-left community that's been there for a long time. And, you know, they can see what's happening in San Francisco. They can see that the San Francisco, the sort of hippie city is gradually dying. And it's being replaced by something that's really not that attractive in some ways.
So the buses, the private buses that are taking a lot of the Google employees from their homes in San Francisco to the Google campus, which are really nice, and the community is, by most accounts, not. That's infuriating people. Is this significant in itself and question of, like, what should be public, what should be private, any of that, or is it just sort of a symbol of other frustrations?
Well, I think it's a symbol of other frustrations. You know, we have to remember that large portions of population, even of San Francisco, are rather poor. And if you look at it relative to cost of living, San Francisco County is among the 10 poorest large counties in the United States, at least according to the PPIC report. So the bottom line is, you know, you have this enormous gap, and increasingly, you know, what you've lost is in San Francisco over time. A lot of corporate headquarters are gone. A lot of middle management jobs are gone. Obviously, the industrial and warehousing sectors are either going or gone. This leaves the techies and an enormous tourism service industry.
But it's got to be very expensive to work in the tourism service industry in a city with very pricey housing and a high cost of living. Groceries getting around. How do they do it? How do they afford to serve?
Well, I think part of it is that if you take a look at the dynamic, you have a lot of people move there in their 20s. San Francisco is very attractive. The Bay Area is very attractive in the group in their 20s. Then they leave in their 30s. San Francisco is number one in terms of movement in cohort 20 to 30 and 31. In 30 to 40, and then just continues to drop. So a lot of it is a question of age. People are willing to live, as they do in New York, in a small apartment that they share with two or three people, because they're going to have fun for a couple of years. When they start thinking about, well, maybe I'd like a little space, maybe I want a little piece of quiet, maybe I want to buy something, maybe I want to get married, maybe I want to have kids, all those things lead people out of San Francisco. San Francisco is, you know, has one of the lowest percentages of people with children in the United States. You know, there are more dogs than kids, famous statistic. But, you know, so it's kind of a weird kind of city. To me, it doesn't feel like the way a city should feel. It doesn't have that kind of, you know, in a sense, the true diversity and the sort of grassroots sort of neighborhood feel that it used to have.
Sure this isn't just like a old person sentimentalist? Because I feel this way about New York 15 years ago. Like, where did it go?
Well, I think it's true for parts of New York, but New York is vast. That's the thing about New York. You know, you've got the 7 train and all those neighborhoods in Northern Queens that are still very interesting and very unique and very distinct. And then, of course, you also have, you know, some of the interesting stuff will start moving more into the suburban areas as they, you know, Fort Lee with the Asian population. The problem that the San Francisco Bay Area has, particularly the peninsula, is everything is expensive. There's becoming fewer and fewer places for people to go. And then of course, people will say, well, what they ought to do is build more high-rise buildings. Well, A, besides the fact high-rise buildings are more expensive, just to make them, they're very expensive. But also, if Ed Glaser had his way and San Francisco became a wall of high-rises like large parts of New York, it wouldn't be San Francisco anymore. You couldn't see the hills. You couldn't see the light. You couldn't see that wonderful shading of that dark blue against the rounded hills that make San Francisco what it is. So there's always that dilemma, too. Even in trying to solve the problem, you can actually make it worse.
That also applies to the robot future.
Right. No, it definitely does. And I think that, you know, I don't think that we can eliminate these moves, but we have to ask ourselves questions like, is this always the best way to go? Should this be controlled by a very small number of companies? Is the kind of competition that made Silicon Valley, again, having studied and worked in Silicon Valley early, it was an enormously competitive place with And now you basically have, really a relatively small handful of companies. The number of companies going public is nothing compared to what it was in 2000.
Sure, and that's why something like WhatsApp is going for $19 billion, is because these guys need to control and consolidate the spaces they're in. At the same time, I don't think anyone finds it hard to imagine there not being a Facebook or a Twitter, the service or the company as we've known it in 10 years. So they have these purely rarefied positions, and there's a sense that they're much more easily disrupted than traditional monopolies, and that's a reason to give them some space. Remember when the whole fight was about Windows Desktop and packaging Internet Explorer, and by the time the courts worked it out, Windows was not the dominant player it still was, and say Microsoft Office still is.
Right. Well, I would go back to look at the many of the companies that came out of that. And they are, if anything, more powerful than they were before. And I think that, you know, you just have – what you've had is you've had the Internet, which – you know, this is a very important point. The Internet was not invented by Steve Jobs. It was not invented by Sergey Brin. It was paid for and developed by the American taxpayer. And we should have some influence as to what direction we want it to take. I think there has to be, it should be a great platform for entrepreneurship, and it very often is. Whether we want to have a world which is so ruthlessly controlled by a small group of people, I think is something that we at least should be debating. Because, you know,
I'm guessing if you polled that question, should the world be ruthlessly controlled by a small group of people? It would. Most people would say no. If that was the formulation.
Yeah, I mean, you would hope, but that's really where we're headed. I mean, that's a very, You know, oligarchies are the product of transitions, just like the Russian oligarchs are. You know, the Soviet Union fell apart. There were all these state assets, and whoever got them were in great shape. Well, there was the Internet revolution, and whoever had not just the technical expertise, but I would really say the financial access. You know, when Silicon Valley venture capitalists said, "Oh, you're a young person in Lexington, Kentucky. You've got a great technology. We'll back you, but you have to move to Silicon Valley." So, you know, one of the things that's really interesting is that when you look at particularly the social media spaces, how little of it is anywhere but Silicon Valley. I mean, you have your little entertainment for the New York media, but the fact of the matter is the vast preponderance is in one place. And that I find, you know, somewhat disturbing, where it's interesting in most other industries, everything is dispersing.
So let's close with this. In what ways is the tech world in what ways are these companies part of an extractive industry? You brought up Russia and its oligarchs. I'm thinking, I mean, what came to mind for me immediately when you brought that up is how they're offering free services to suck in all this information that's really valuable and can be sold. Right. But I think there's probably a few ways that applies. I know you're plainly a skeptic. Take me through that, how they're extractive.
Well, they're extractive in the sense that they take people's information and then they sell it to advertisers, and that becomes the business, their business they're in. Now, the interesting thing will be, are they slicing and dicing this revenue so much that at some point it just will not justify the valuations they currently have? And that I think is entirely possible. But in the meantime,
are they traditionally extractive in terms of like energy use, or how they're drifting and sifting populations to, you know, cluster engineers in certain places and all that, or is that taking it too far?
Well, I think one of the things that they do use an awful lot of power. I mean, all these devices are tremendous power sucks.
But the servers are ridiculous.
Right, but the servers, what they do is they put them in the Pacific Northwest where there's very inexpensive electricity, or they move them into parts of the South, which oddly enough are running on coal. But they're, you know, fundamentally,
Somebody needs to make a chart of that. The internet runs on coal.
Well, I'm sure. Look, there's no question. It's just because, you know, about half the electricity in the country still comes from coal. And, you know, it's gradually being replaced by natural gas, but it's going to take time. And that's a whole nother issue. But the key thing here is that they are taking people's information and selling them to advertisers. That's what the basis of their wealth is. I think that that's, I don't know how great a social virtue that is. And I think there are as many negatives as positives in that process.
Well, Joel, thanks a lot for taking the time, and, we'll get this all resolved in our next conversation, I am sure.
Okay,
get things right again.
Okay, great. Thank you.